And good afternoon. It is just about. It's 5 seconds until 4 o'clock. How's that? And just a quick mention you know what? I'm going to go ahead and just do this first, and then I'll be right back. How's that?
CFRC 101.9 FM has launched its annual funding drive to raise $25,000 to support station operations, news and creative programming, and upgrades to our recording and performance studios. You can make a difference. Visit CFRC.ca right now and make your gift. Get a tax receipt or sweet, sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. Thank you for your support.
And I just thought I'd throw that in there, just a short plug about our funding drive, just a quick mention of it here before we really get into the meat of today's show, I guess. I'll be talking about it later at the in between both of the featured events that I'm airing and then also at the end of the show for a few minutes. But it is just our annual funding drive that started November 1st and runs through December 31st, so we're just over halfway through. We have a goal of $25,000. If you'd like to kind of check it out, go to www.cfrc.ca and just click on the donate tab at the top of the page, and it will explain everything about the funding drive. But again, I'll give my own personal take on it a little bit, a couple of times this hour and next. So with that said, good afternoon. It is 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. And my name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today in the first hour from a November 11th event at Novel Idea Bookstore, you'll hear Donna Nebersall joined in conversation with writer Mark Abley as she launches her new book. It's a memoir called To Linger With You. In the second hour, you'll hear from a November 23rd event held at Leopard Frog Farm, Ann Archer launching her new poetry collection called Prompted. Woven throughout that reading were instrumental interludes that she and Chris Coleman performed. They together known as Dragonfly. And so let's just go ahead and jump right into that first launch. Again, here is Donna Nebersall with her book, To Linger With You. Here we go.
We'll get going. My name's Mark Abley. This is Donna Nebersall, whom you're here to hear talk tonight. But I'll introduce Donna first. I'd like to acknowledge first that the land we're meeting on is the traditional territory of many nations, including the Haudenosaunee Confederacy and the Anishinaabeg, and that Kingston is now home to many diverse First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people. Thank you so much to Novel Idea for the giving Donna the opportunity to be here tonight, and also for the spread of cheese and I think some other food and drinks in there. So we will have time before the store closes to partake of that. And there are also books in front that you can get signed, and I think Donna would be happy to do that. So first, a bit of introduction for anyone who doesn't know Donna. The book is called To Linger With You, A Memoir of Sunshine and Longing, published by Stonehewer Books. And while it's a memoir of an unusual childhood, it's also a lot more. As you'll hear, Donna spent her childhood in Georgetown, the capital of British Guiana, and she immigrated to this country at the age of 10. She studied at Loyola College and McGill University and began a long and distinguished career as a journalist. For many years, she worked as an editor, columnist, and feature writer at the Montreal Gazette, where I had the pleasure of being her colleague for many years. Donna has retired from the daily grind of journalism, but she continues to be a part-time faculty member in the Department of Journalism at Concordia University. She's written one previous book, Womankind: Faces of Change Around the World, in collaboration with the photographer Nance Ackerman. She also conceived and wrote the script for a documentary called Twice Upon a Garden, and she founded the environmental blog Earthbound. Donna is a great traveler, a gardener, and a yoga teacher. She and her husband, Mark Swift, divide their time between Montreal and Big Tankook Island off the coast of Nova Scotia. They have two children and a new grandson. Please welcome Donna Nevensaw.
And portraits.
Pardon me?
And portraits.
Right.
She published portraits.
Oh, that's true. Actually, that was the series of day books. I was just telling B about this, that had photographs.
Right.
Yes, so that began Womankind.
Okay. I put my spritzer in front of a book called The Broadview Book of Common Errors in English, and it seems that was an appropriate way to start off the evening. So put my glass somewhere else now. Donna, you do a wonderful job of setting the scene, helping us imagine the backdrop in which your childhood unfolded. The first chapter is called The House on Brickdam Street, where you and your little brother lived with your grandparents. Could you read a short passage from that chapter?
Can I just ask you a quick question?
Of course.
Are you a photographer then?
No.
Okay.
Sorry, why?
Oh, she tried to be a photographer.
Okay. Let's carry on with the book. We'll have time for questions at the end, so let's carry on.
Oh, yes, sorry, very good. Okay.
So this piece is about... We grew up in a big white house in Georgetown, which is the capital, a city of Guyana, British Guyana at the time. And as we'll find out later, my brother and I grew up basically being cared for by our grandparents. And so in this big house, there were many rooms. I think that's biblical, right?
Yes.
So anyway, let me read this. My grandparents' bedroom at the front of the house opened onto the tower, with windows on three sides. In one corner near the entry, a small high shelf held a statue of the infant Jesus of Prague, wearing a golden crown, red cloak, and high collar, and holding an orb. But I never went in there to pray. I went to spend time with the people who sat in the two big rocking chairs that dominated the room. Every night, Grandfather would sit in his rocker alongside the open casement window at the front of the room, and Granny in hers beside the other windows facing him. This was their routine, he in his striped pajamas, she in her nightie and dressing gown, every night before bed, rocking and talking quietly, or just sitting with their rosaries and their thoughts. In one corner stood an upright Singer sewing machine, folded into its wooden shell, and piled on top a few small pillows, zippered and tightly trimmed. Stuffed in those pillows, we were told, was Granny's long auburn hair that she cut off when she became a mother. Before I went to bed, I would climb onto Granny's lap as she rocked slowly in the night, inhaling the sweet fragrance of the Nivea cream that she would rub on her hands, smoothing it gently on her fine, mottled skin. She had small hands with strong, blunt fingers and short nails. No-nonsense hands. I would sometimes trace the veins under her soft skin and feel the bumps around the knuckles thickened with arthritis. She would massage her fingers occasionally, but her knees hurt the most. She was not yet 60 and quite round, and would often sit and rub her swollen knees in a circular motion, complaining quietly.
Thank you. So why were your parents not there? Why were you living with your grandparents?
Well, the story of South America really was that...
Let's forget South America. Let's just deal with your parents.
All right. My parents. My parents had moved to Trinidad when they met and before they married. And when they... I was born there. But 4 months after my birth, my father, 25 years old, died. And my mother came back to Georgetown, And eventually, because her siblings were leaving, they were coming to Canada one by one. This was in the 50s into the 60s when the country was becoming independent. So my mother, who in my looking back on it, I realize was probably traumatized by the death of my father. She left us there, my brother and I, and came to Canada. And so we stayed in there in South America until I was 10 years old.
Right.
So that childhood basically took place without my mother or my father. Excuse me.
And this was a Portuguese Catholic family. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about a little bit, not too long, about British Guiana and about the place of the Portuguese and why they were there and what kind of place they held in the society?
Mm-hmm. So the Portuguese had come from Madeira. So we were not Portuguese from the mainland, but from this island, which had been developed by that country because it was very fertile, incredibly fertile, and they grew grapes and they grew sugar. But there were, at this particular juncture, which was the mid-1800s, it was the end of slavery in South America. The British ended slavery. That country, British Guiana, basically was worked by slaves until that moment. So they needed labor in the sugarcane estates, or we call them plantations, that they had. And there were many of them owned by British. And so they brought Portuguese at that period. There was also difficulties with the crops. People were farmers and they were hungry. And they came over. They took that very long trip, about 30,000 of them, over not very many years. They came to British Guiana and they settled. Now, they didn't spend a long time in those plantations. It was terribly hard work. And so they ended up becoming merchants, and they bought properties, you know, and they opened shops. And so that was the tradition I was born into, you know, and especially my grandparents, both my grandparents, their parents had come from Portugal or Madeira, and they both had mothers who owned things. Sorry, it was very matrilineal in that sense.
Right.
Sorry, I have a cough. Excuse me.
Have a sip of water
while I
talk a little bit then. And so just to fill in what Donna was saying a bit more, by the time Donna was growing up, there were a lot of people who come from the Indian subcontinent, and so as indentured laborers, so they were kind of filling in on the plantations. And the Portuguese are doing very well in Georgetown, and your grandfather managed a big department store, right?
Yes. So we grew up in a very privileged sort of situation. My grandfather was, I'd say you'd call it, if you want to qualify it here, upper middle class. It was a big house. We had servants. We had a cook named Cookie. And we had a gardener, a beautiful gardener, who was Indian and who wore silver bells around her, silver ankle bracelets. Anyway, and so it was a lovely life. It was a beautiful life.
And Cookie must have cooked extremely well, because your pages in these early chapters are full of wonderful writing about food. So feel free to read one or even two passages, if you want, about the food you grew up with.
Okay. Yes. We gathered every day for lunch, including Grandfather, who would sit with us over a leisurely meal, then rest before returning in mid-afternoon to Betancourt's. We always celebrated when Cookie made Metam G, another childhood delight, a concoction of root vegetables cooked in a broth of coconut milk. I would slather the thick coconut sauce over the yams, edos, and plantain, and mash them all together, savoring the fragrant, earthy flavor. Other times, Cookie would make chow mein, a West Indian variety without bean sprouts. She brought it to the table on a platter, a huge mound of flat egg noodles loaded with vegetables and sliced hard-boiled eggs. I enjoyed black pudding, a fat sausage filled with rice mixed with black congealed blood and many spices, served sliced and best eaten without thinking too hard about its contents. And I look forward to delectable salt fish, another stew, this one with shreds of long-soaked salt cod, soft rounds of onion and slices of hard-boiled egg in a buttery broth. Sometimes at lunch, Cookie would bring a jug of lemonade to the table, or my favorite, sorrel, a clear red drink with an unforgettable herbal sweetness made by soaking sorrel, a tropical hibiscus flower, in water with ginger, orange peel, and cinnamon sticks. It would then be strained and sweetened and served in an ice-filled glass. Granny, on the other hand, always favored more healthy foods, except for special occasions when she would make ice cream in a large metal churn. We loved to watch as the interior well, surrounded by tightly packed ice and rock salt, filled up with thick milk and vanilla. Then the lid would be screwed on, and Granny, with a little help from us children, would turn the crank until she deemed the ice cream ready. No ice cream is ever compared to the creamy, vanilla-studded mixture we ate in little white bowls.
Thank you. And you should know that this person who writes so well about black congealed blood and also about pepper pot in another passage is a confirmed vegetarian. So
I had my fill of delicious meat.
Okay. What we haven't talked about at all is the other people who were in the house and in the neighborhood. So it wasn't just you, your brother, and your grandparents. Who else was there?
Well, growing up, two of my aunts, Auntie Lucille and Auntie Olga, when I was growing up in the house, in addition to all the cousins who lived in the house next door, they were the two, I guess, young people who were still at home. And there were, early on, I had other uncles, but slowly, though, they started moving away. So it was really Auntie Olga and Auntie Lou who would sort of be there around us, and we attended both their weddings, myself and my brother and my cousins, and they would take us with them in the summer when we had our holidays. Again, this is hearkening to colonial life. There was one of the sugarcane estates was called Wales, and Wales was a place of incredible beauty and fun because it was sited on the Demerara River on one side, which is a huge kind of, I don't want to say murky, but yes, murky river.
Where Demerara sugar.
That's right. Demerara sugar and Demerara rum both come from there. And there was a canal on the other side. There were a row of houses where they were called overseers. All the overseers lived, and then there was a long canal, and the big metal punts would go slowly down this canal, just covered with sugarcane, and they would go to the factory somewhere down the canal to be cooked, and you could smell the burnt sugar in the. It was quite a beautiful experience.
Yeah. You and your brother went to very different schools. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, I was a very kind of studious kid. I think partly because no one realized that I couldn't actually see very well. And I spent a lot of time with my face in a book. So I kind of studied. I didn't, want to excel or anything. I just sort of did. So my grandparents sent me to a convent school. It was run by the Ursuline sisters, who I thought were amazingly wonderful. I used to try to emulate the way the...
And where were they from?
America. They came from the U.S. I mean, the Ursulines have been all over Canada as well, Quebec City. But anyway, so I loved school, and I would get ferried to and from school either on the back of a bicycle or my grandfather's, one of the porters. These words are terrible, eh? They're so laden with colonialism. Anyway, they would drive me in a van to school and back. My brother, on the other hand, was sent to a public school down the road, And, you know, compared to my little workbooks and my pens and pencils that I used, my brother wrote everything on a slate with a chalk, and they would hit the kids. You know, they would wrap their knuckles when they misbehaved and stuff like that. Mm. And because of it, my brother, I think, was... Well, he played hooky. He was traumatized enough that one day I came home from school, and there he was, like, in a room under the house. Because all the houses are built up high. They're built one floor up, and so there was a room in this house, and my brother had hidden there every day, and I think came home for lunch, and then went back just to try to get away from this horrible place.
Yeah. So for you, if not your brother, it sounds in many ways quite idyllic.
Mm-hmm.
And the subtitle of the book is A Memoir of Sunshine and Longing, which I think is a really interesting pair of nouns to put together. Why the sunshine and why the longing?
Well, I think the sunshine has to do with this tropical childhood. You know, it has to do with all the things that I remember so extremely well about that place. Because even though these things had happened in our story, we didn't dwell on it. We knew we had a mother. We knew she... to me, my mother was a cross between Elizabeth Taylor and the Queen. That's how I visualized her. We knew she loved us, but we didn't know her at all. So we didn't know that kind of parental experience at all. And a lot of, I guess, the gap between the childhood that I lived there in this very beautiful tropical environment, where I didn't really know that what was going on with independence. You know, we just kind of lived this kind of very, very West Indian life. It was so different after coming to Canada. So I'd say sunshine is the beginning, is those first 10 years. And then coming to Canada was it was such a gigantic change. Like, so, you know, you can describe sort of the idea of one childhood that was embedded in my memory when I began to live another, which was in this country,
right,
which was completely and utterly different.
Right.
And so getting back to longing, if we want to talk about the longing, so that part of my life became, as I grew older, which is in a way the second part of this book, is about searching for the parents and grandparents that I lost on my father's side.
Right. I should mention that the book has quite a number of really beautiful black and white period photographs, and Donna's mother was indeed gorgeous. Indeed, the publisher kind of fell in love with Donna's mother and wanted to include lots more pictures of her.
It's true.
So when you... Let's... Moving on a little bit. When you... you're, I think, what, about 10 years old, and all of a sudden this tropical idyll is coming to an end. You're going to be going to Canada. How did you feel? What was that process like for you, leaving this beautiful place?
We had come once before because tropical kind of holidays. My grandfather probably had a few months off. We'd come to Canada when maybe I was 6 years old for a month, maybe on board ship, which was a fabulous experience for us. We carried bauxite from...
Not you personally.
No, the ship. And also cows, which was really exciting, you know, in a storm for little kids to be wandering around. No one sat us down and said, you're leaving now. You're going to be leaving in a week. We're going to take you back, we're going to take you to your parents, to your mom. There was the day arrived. I had a little red coat, and that was the biggest clue, my little red winter coat that was made for me so that I could manage in the Canadian winters, which, of course, didn't work at all. and I guess the realization that it was happening came to me because I suffered from this incredibly terrible headache, which was the first time I'd ever had a headache. So I kind of lay there, you know, in the bunk bed, and people came to me to give me goodbye presents, you know, and I guess my body realized something was happening, even though my mind was not really registering it.
And then you arrived in Montreal.
Yes.
So tell us about your first months in Montreal in Canada.
Well, I think it was originally it was rather exciting. First of all, because we lived in an apartment, and I couldn't believe you could fit an entire house into an apartment, you know, and still have bedrooms and a kitchen and all of that. And we lived in Montreal in a place that was right across the road from a big ice cream parlor called Elmhurst Dairy. And so you could see people going in to get their ice creams, and it was exciting. And I got to walk to school and wear knee socks. I remember the knee socks, and I remember my knees kind of turning blue. And I remember, I don't know, we walked. It must have been a good half an hour walk. And at that point, we're little kids, but I guess that in that time, you could do something like that. And I did all the things that kids do, including, you know, decide to try to go into the apartment building. It had a big iron metal bar across it, and I decided to stick my tongue out
in winter.
You know, in winter. So luckily, I think I must have been breathing heavily because I loosened my tongue came away without me losing any skin. But so it was. I don't want to say it was difficult, but it was definitely a new world.
Right.
And as a young student, so I went into school in grade four, and I had this. I looked maybe like everybody else, but I had this heavy West Indian accent, and I kind of made the mistake of trying to fit in by being a really, really good kid. So I used to stay after school and help the teacher. And, you know, rub off all the stuff on the board.
Terrible way to fit in.
Oh, terrible. Well, it was terrible because she was kind of not a nice person.
The teacher.
Yeah. Miss Wimby.
Right. For anyone who knows Montreal, I should say this was Western NDG.
Mm-hmm.
Upper Lachine Road, right?
Yeah, Upper Lachine Road. Yeah.
And you still went to church and were a good Catholic girl, but your mother didn't go to church anymore.
No.
But one day you overheard her on the phone saying, "Yes, Father."
Mm.
Tell us about that.
My brother and I, because I think my grandparents were practicing Catholics, but they were kind of low-key about it. We went to church on Sundays, but we didn't sort of, and they would say their rosaries, but we didn't have any overt kind of, you know, kneeling down in May to say whatever. But by the time we got to Canada and I realized that my mother wasn't going to church, I really began to worry a lot that she was definitely, you know, she was going to go to hell. So she took us to church, but they never went. And so when this particular day I heard her saying on the phone, you know, those little phone tables with the seat, mm-hmm. you know, that used to, when the hall, everybody had the rotary phones, and she was saying, "Yes, Father, thank you, Father." And I said, I thought jokingly, "Are you talking to a priest? Are you getting married?" And my mother said, "Yes." And I was absolutely horrified. I burst into tears because I had done a lot of reading. I knew what happened to Cinderella. I knew that she would. I knew this kid with a stepfather was going to wear rags and have to sweep the house with a twig broom. So my mother spent a long time trying convincing me that this was not the terrible horror that I imagined that it would be. And so again, these pieces were all sort of a new world. You know, children go along in their lives and they live in the present moment and they accept whatever is happening. So, but this transition was so gigantic from something that is common and expected to, you know, this cold country, this apartment, this man, you know, who is going to become my stepfather, and I did not want that. So it was a struggle that we had to, without it becoming, I mean, I didn't have terrible tantrums except for that particular one.
Yeah.
But,
So, before we move on to the next sort of part of the book, I want to ask you about the process of remembering and writing, because there aren't photographs in the book from your teenage years. The photographs are mostly or entirely, I think, from British Guiana. Did the photographs, how do they help you? I mean, could you have written the book without those photographs? And was the process of writing very different when you were able to look at the photographs compared to how it was when you're writing about your years in NDG and then Pointe Claire and the western suburb of Montreal when you didn't have these so many photographs to work from?
I mean, I think I have a visual memory that I do. I can, if I spend time with things, which I think you need to do to remember, that I can really kind of bring back those textures and the way things looked and how they felt. But the photography was, it was my father's photo album that I began to work with originally. And so, and those things were incredibly wonderful to bring, because I spent a lot of time with them. And I think the lesson for me was that it's about that exactly. It's about spending time with something. It's about sitting with a photograph and really looking at it, or about remembering, you know, an event and sort of really thinking about what did it feel like? What color was the sky? How did the sun feel on my skin? All of those things are, you can only do, I think, if you sort of decide to sit with it and to work on that narrative, which is, in a way, the story of your identity. It's the story of who you are. So it was a great exercise for me. Yes. I mean, I would do it again and again.
You mentioned your father. Is there just a short passage you could read about when you started to think more about him, or just started to think about him in a different way? Because I guess growing up, you'd always been aware that he died as a very young man, but maybe the full weight of that hadn't sunk in. Page 6.
Oh, really?
Donna and I have done this before.
Yeah, we have. Oh, okay. Yes, here it is.
The first clue that I was treading on shaky ground. Oh, actually, let me start a little bit earlier.
Sure.
Okay. Isn't it always so with children who accept what they see, rarely questioning the current of uncertainty that might ripple beneath the surface? My brother George and I grew up thinking there was nothing strange about being raised by grandparents instead of parents, only glancingly aware that our father had died, and knowing without understanding that our mother had made the choice to live in another country. But if the circumstances were odd, tragic even, I didn't understand that during my childhood years. We were part of a responsible, devoted family of Portuguese who had migrated generations earlier from Madeira to South America. We lived a well-ordered life. We might have been parentless, but George and I grew up with the certainty that this was our home. These were our people. We felt special. The first clue that I was treading on shaky ground manifested in my early teens, when I was recounting to a friend the story of my father's sudden death. I began to speak, sketching out the details as I had done over the years, when something shifted. My breath constricted in my chest, my voice tightened, and it dawned on me with a sickening shock. In that empty space, I once had a father. just like everyone else did. I had a father, except he was gone. I realized it, and as much as I could, being a self-centered teenager, I felt it. My father's life had ended, and we had been left to carry on without him. I struggled to turn everything into a pretty story after that.
So, who was your father? And if you want to carry on into that, who were your father's parents? Mm.
So, the story that, you know, there was not much of a story about my father's family, because he was gone, and his mother had died before him. And so when I grew up, I knew nothing about him except that he had a sister who lived in the U.S. So when my first child was about a year and a half old, we went to visit her, my Aunt Gloria, because I wanted to ask, you know, who these people were. The question was often, what was he like? Who was this man? And no one could ever tell me that. They told me he was handsome. That was the most common word. He was handsome. And my aunts would tell me about how lots of women liked him. You know, and then there was my mother. And so it was a romantic story, but it had no kind of substance at all.
You said he died suddenly, but you haven't said how he died.
So my father, as best I know, I don't have a death certificate, he died of a duodenal ulcer that hemorrhaged. So basically he died overnight. And he bled to death, basically. And my mother, years later, I asked her, and she rarely talked about him. She would remember his birthday and call me on April 29th every year. But she said once, when I slept, I used to dream of blood. So I think that it was a traumatic, really traumatic experience for her. And so I was left with this photo album, and then I was left with a story around his mother, who was considered to be a beautiful English girl because she was 16 when she met my grandfather, Joseph, who had come to South America for some reason from Europe. And then they went back to Europe, and my father was born in Monte Carlo, and he was French-speaking for the first 4 years of his life because he grew up in Paris, or he was a child in Paris. So this was basically the entire story that I knew.
Did his sister tell you more when you went
to
visit her?
Well, not really, because Gloria, there was a kind of strange, a different kind of symmetry, but a symmetry nonetheless, because my grandfather and grandmother had my father, and later on another child, my Aunt Gloria, left them in South America and went back to Europe. And so there they were kind of doing the same thing almost that my mother had done, except not in happy circumstances. Their grandparents were not my grandparents. And so when my grandmother showed up again a few years later back in South America, my Aunt Gloria thought actually she was getting her parents back. In fact, she only got back her mother and another child, because in the meantime my grandmother had left my grandfather and married another person.
It's getting pretty complicated.
Joseph.
Yeah. So you say in the book that when your first child was born, you had a phone call.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, you know, when you'd put in those little birth notices in the paper in those days, and it would always say Nebensol Donna and Swift Mark, that's my husband, and somebody would call me up and say, Nebensol, are you, you know, I have family, Nebensols, from Poland, you know, do you know them? And I would always say, no, I don't know. I'm not that Nebensol. I'm a South American Nebensol.
You're a Portuguese Catholic.
I'm a Portuguese Catholic. But I thought that I thought that he was must have had some relationship with that country, and that's why he was there. So it took me a long time to realize that there was something to the story. And I would do kind of, I would look at it from time to time. And then one day I sort of, I got help from a friend who sent me to a person in Montreal named Stanley Diamond, who was involved with the Holocaust Museum. And Stanley Diamond sent me to a researcher in Antwerp, and she started to look. And in the, at the same time, one of the big impetus, a big impetus was that I found the name Joseph Nebenzahl on the Shoah Memorial in Paris. And the Shoah Memorial lists all the French Jews who were killed in the Holocaust. And the date of birth, the year of birth, I think we had a discrepancy, 1895 or 1896. So Jackie Schwartz, the woman in Antwerp, started to do that research for me. And we uncovered my grandfather, who stayed in Europe after, you know, Ina, my grandmother, who had gone from there to New York and then married somebody else and then went back to Guyana. He was there in the mid to late 1930s, and he was there in 1944, which is when he was picked up in Marseille, sent to Drancy, the internment camp, and then sent to Auschwitz. So I had, not only was this a tragedy, but suddenly I had a new story, you know.
A new identity, almost.
A new identity, almost.
Yeah.
Which has been incredible, you know. So it took me quite a long time, first of all, to even want to pay attention to it, and then to kind of realize it, you know.
You have two kids. How did they react to this discovery that, that part of their heritage was not at all what they'd grown up thinking it was?
Well, I think this book is going to help them quite a lot, because I don't think we really... It wasn't something that I could really talk about. It was sort of like this revelation, this unfolding, you know, of another life. And so this, the book, you know, ends up really talking to a research. It's research in the second part of it, where I'm trying to, I guess, come to terms with it or really understand it or believe it, you know, that this is actually... the story, part of the story of my life.
You worked as a journalist for many years. How do you think that your upbringing and everything you've been describing, did that affect your career at all?
Probably. I mean, I think that I think I've always sort of seen myself as an observer, and when I see myself in situations, that's what I see that person kind of doing. So I certainly, that was the case in my childhood, where I remembered all of these moments and things that I saw. I mean, but I think a journalist is an observer. So yeah, I do think it helped me a lot. And in the, also just in the course of I have a huge love of writing. So it's really very special to be able to sort of use that.
How about being an immigrant? Was that also something that played into your work over the years?
I think so. I mean, to some extent, because, well, I don't know, it's part of the distance that you might feel. There are many people in this country, or many people that I surrounded myself with, who were not immigrants. I think the immigrant... the immigrant experience is very particular, because I don't think that immigrants, by and large, want to leave home. They want to stay. They want the life, but they can't have it. So I guess that's longing for you.
Right.
So I guess that was part of, yeah, and maybe in terms of what you see when you tell people's stories, you know, it's this idea of who deeply are you, you know?
We're getting close to the end of my question, so I'm going to ask a couple things more, and then if you people want to have, if you have questions, if there are things you'd like to talk about with Donna, I'll throw the floor open to you, so to speak. But there's a couple... Now you got me going.
Uh-oh, sorry.
There's a couple of paragraphs near the end of the book in which you talk about your memory, your sense of home, and what it's come to mean to you.
Yes.
So maybe you could read that.
I'll try that. Would you like something to drink?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. What did those early sunshine years give me in that country I remember so well, vivid yet forever lost? I thought many times about going back to visit, and I'm encouraged by the push underway in Guyana to carve out a place for itself as an eco-conscious destination, though leery about its discovery of massive oil deposits, troubling as our climate crisis deepens. But I can't bring myself to see my grandparents' home in its new guise as a government building, even though I'm stunned to discover that it also houses the honorary consulate of Trinidad and Tobago. It's as though my story is still lodged there. It doesn't have the tower anymore, Auntie Olga exclaimed, and the room under the house is gone. But it doesn't matter about the physical place, because I believe I've found a new home for my family in these memories and historical records. Mary Folk, our psychotherapist and author, says that the act of writing memoir is its own form of dwelling or abode making. My memory, however fallible, lives in the writing. This is where I've created my own home of words.
Beautiful. Donna, why did you want to write this book?
I guess I wanted to do it really because I wanted to record this story. I wanted to remember. And as I said earlier, this a sitting with memory is kind of a beautiful exercise. And so, I mean, I could say, yes, I did it for my ancestors. You know, I did it so there would be a record of these people and what they did. But for me, it was an incredible kind of journey. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Do you have questions? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I thought I saw you put up your hand.
Yeah. So, were you able to have some semblance of forgiveness with your mom, given how that went later on? I don't know if that's too personal.
No. Yeah. It was, and I think there was a period of growing up where I definitely was, I didn't understand some of the things that she did. And I do think she faltered, you know. There would have been a better way of telling us that she was getting married to someone. But I do think that she struggled. And after I had my first child, I remember thinking, I would never leave my child, ever. And I asked her, you know, how could you do that? And she said, you have no idea how many nights I cried myself to sleep. So I think my mother did this because she felt it was the right thing to do, because we were safe and cared for. And, you know, this was the 1950s, and I don't think you could have come to Canada with a little child or with two little children and made a life. So that's why. I think that's why.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Would you have the choice to stay with your grandparents at that time? Are they saying you're going back? Did you have a choice, or that was a... you're going to Canada?
Oh, there was no choice. But there was not like, oh, you're going to Canada. We just kind of just, here you go.
Slipped into Canada.
That's right. We just went. I mean, it was not sort of, this is what's going to happen to you. The only thing my grandmother did tell us was that in Canada, children were kidnapped. So we had better be really careful.
Oh, my God.
And my brother was a very kind of happy-go-lucky guy. So even on the ship, I had to really pay attention, because he was very cute, and he was really into stuff. Like, he loved, you know, he had somebody gave him a little outboard motor, And so I lost him, and I had to go find him. And he was in some sailor's room playing the outboard motor in a sink, you know. But I took it very seriously.
Like a mom to him?
Pardon?
Were you like a mom?
I don't really think so. I mean, our grandparents were there. I just think that when my grandmother said, you know, you better be careful in this country, you have to be careful. Okay. Children get kidnapped. It was a heavy thing to say.
Your grandparents came with you on the ship, and
yes.
then they stayed for a bit, and then they went back to British Guiana.
Yeah.
Okay, this, I might sound really ignorant saying this question.
Yes.
Where in South America is British Guiana?
There's three Guyanas. It's on the north, slightly eastern tip of South America. There's British Guiana, French Guiana, and Dutch Guiana, which is called Suriname.
Okay, so there's Colombia, and it's north of Colombia?
Yeah, it's right on the coast. It's on the ocean.
It's facing the Caribbean Sea.
Yeah, it's facing, yes. And it's Brazil and Venezuela are both have borders there. Three quarters of it is jungle, is rainforest.
They're small countries.
Okay.
Very small countries.
Mm. Okay, because I'm familiar with many countries in South America, but I wasn't familiar with those.
Yes. French Guiana was made famous by Papillon, because it has a devil, what's it called? The prison on it.
Devil's Island.
Yeah. Devil's Island.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And French Guiana is still an overseas département of France.
Of France.
Believe it or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because I know that I thought the only country in South America that speaks Portuguese is Brazil.
It doesn't speak Portuguese. It's the only English-speaking country in South America.
Oh, English-speaking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Portuguese came there, but they weren't the majority. So in the country gained its independence, which was in the 60s, early 60s. The two major populations were Indian, who had come over, many hundreds of thousands, really, as indentured labor, and the black population, who had been brought there as slaves. They were the people who, and still are, the majority in that country.
So you grew up learning English?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
We even had pound, shillings, and pence. We even had tea at 4 o'clock. We did it all.
Pictures of the Queen on the classroom.
Pictures of the Queen, yes.
Wow.
Yes. I mean, when you see in the Caribbean, you know, you see little kids going to school and they're wearing those cute little uniforms, you know, that's all British. That's all the British, you know.
So, you arrived from British Guiana. In Montreal.
Yeah.
Which was very Catholic.
Yeah.
Very French.
Mm-hmm.
And not that tolerant of immigrants.
Mm. I don't know. I didn't have that experience. It may have been true if I was noticeably from somewhere else. But basically, I think I blended in quite
well.
And it was interesting because I had friends who were... Well, I met the first Polish kid I ever knew, or the first Italian kid I ever knew, because that's not how I grew up.
Because you were Catholic.
Yeah,
you were Catholic, so that was a great advantage for you.
Totally.
Yes.
Totally.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so that part of it, and we went to St. Ignatius, you know, of Loyola.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to Catholic schools.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And those were the days of nuns and all that stuff.
Oh yes, yeah.
You remember that?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
except I was Greek Orthodox.
Oh yeah. Okay, that's different.
Yes.
Okay, you would have noticed.
Yep.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And then you found out you were Jewish.
Partly. Although, you know, as I mentioned in the book, formally Judaism is matrilineal.
Exactly.
So after figuring all this stuff out, then I had to say to myself, well, it wasn't her, it was him, so I'm not Jewish. And then I decided to heck with that. If I'm claiming this. I decided I'm claiming him, I'm claiming this Jewish heritage. I'm not abiding by some rule or other, you know. So
do your children identify
no,
as Jewish.
No, no, no. Anyway, I'm not religious. I don't identify as any
with
religion.
Anything. Yeah.
No, that's
I mean, I think, if I can just jump in, I think that's one of the great things about living in the 21st century, which I often deplore and complain about and, you know, think I would have been much happier in the 19th in many ways. But here, the great thing about living in the 21st century is that someone can be Canadian mm-hmm. and have a Jewish heritage and a Catholic heritage and a Portuguese heritage, and it doesn't matter. I mean, we're just who we are, and that, I think that's a great thing.
Mm-hmm. Progress.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I think so. But it was interesting sort of to see that this mix of people, you know, and we ended up in the suburbs of Montreal, Pointe-Claire. So that was another, when there were masses of kids, you know, so many kids that they overflowed the high school. So that was, we were the boomers, right?
Yeah.
Any other questions, comments? Yeah.
What's the biggest gift this book unlocked after the fact? Even if you had some thought of what it was going to do.
Great. That's a great question. I think actually I discovered how much I love to do this. I really love to do it. I mean, if just the process of writing and thinking about it and spending time with it was a real gift. And I guess, I mean, well, it's pretty clear that it brought back a lot of this kind of beautiful tropical childhood, and it gave me this whole aspect of my life that is a bigger story somewhere. But it was just that to be able to do the writing was wonderful.
And again, I'm going to jump in a little bit because I've also written some books, but I also worked as a journalist for a long time. And I think working as a journalist, what we had to do was always to be ready to move on to the next
That's
thing.
Right.
We could hardly ever dwell mm-hmm. on what we were asked to write about or even what we decided to mm-hmm. write about mm-hmm. because there was always the pressure for the next story, you know. Writing a book feels like a luxury in some ways, you know, even though it's many years since I left the Montreal Gazette, but it's still the luxury of time and to be able to concentrate on a single project.
Mm. But it's like your painting. This is what I can compare it to, right? It's your painting that you're working at.
Yes, totally.
And you have to complete that image
right.
that you're focusing on, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think, too, you know, they say that the thing that transports you, you know, it's like, speaking of painting, there's this artist named Agnes Martin who did these incredible work. Anyway, I saw her stuff at the Guggenheim, and she said, sometimes for half a day, I would never even think. Mm-hmm. Like, she would just paint. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you have something that where you lose track of time,
yes,
I mean, that's a great experience to do something like that. And, you know, Margaret Atwood says, Margaret Atwood, the great memoir writer, says, that there's a book called The Gift, and it's about creativity
yeah.
that is the greatest gift. And I think that's 100% true,
yes.
you know.
Well, if there aren't any more questions, I'll thank Donna on behalf of everyone and just remind you all that there's drink and food and books to buy and a person who's willing to sign them. So
thank you. And also, give me a second because I want to thank Mark, who really didn't have to come here tonight. He did it as a big favor to me. So I really appreciate it. He lives down the road, so...
Yeah, exactly.
I shamed... No, I didn't shame you. No, he said... Anyway, we've done this a few times already, and it's a real pleasure.
Thank you. Great.
And you just heard... from a November 11th event at the Novel Idea Bookstore, Donna Nebersall in conversation with Mark Abley. And as she launched her new book called A Memoir. And I'm having trouble with my mic here. Just a sec. Called To Linger With You. And it is 59 minutes after 4 o'clock. And right now, before we move into the second segment of the show today, my heartfelt thanks to all of you out there for tuning into this first hour. And to Donna and Mark. That